Blog Talk Radio.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Listeners, and welcome to the Dynamic Dojo Talk Radio Show with Lucita de Jesus and Robert Deal. It's Sunday, April 13th, and I am joined on the helm by Sifu Bob. Bob, how you doing today?
Oh, doing well. Weather is beautiful. Couldn't ask for anything more. Now, a couple things happened this week. Well, you know, things are changing. I'm not too particularly up on all the changes, but A few months ago, I was working with this girl, and she called into this company. You know the voicemail systems where it asks you to punch in certain numbers. You know, you can talk, talk to your party, punch in their extension. Well, you remember the pound symbol, the tic-tac-toe?
Yeah.
As far as I can remember, it's been known for pound forever. Now, they're changing that because of Twitter on these messages, and I heard it for the first time. They're switching it. You can press the this and then the hash or pound sign. I'm going, are you kidding me?
So they're calling it a hash sign now?
They're calling it a hash sign now. And I'm like, I told my wife this, and I said, well, maybe I'm just an old fuddy-duddy. And she starts cracking up, and she says, I'm glad you said it before I did.
Gotta love her.
And I was watching Jimmy Fallon the other night. First time I'd ever seen him since he took over the Tonight Show. And he was – one of his bits – you remember Carnac on the old Johnny Carson? Well, he has this thing that he calls – that he writes thank you notes during his show. So he's writing thank you notes, and he gets down to one, and he says, now, for anybody who doesn't know, LBJ or Lyndon Baines Johnson was the vice president of the United States during the Kennedy administration. So in the 60s. So he says, thank you, LBJ, for being a great vice president and not a Mexican porn star.
Oh, my God.
I thought that was so funny. And, you know, it was – I had to think about that for a second. And I went, oh, my God, no, he didn't.
Yes, he did. Oh, no, he didn't. Yes, he did. Oh, my God. So, listeners out there, our phone number here is 347-677-0699. And stay tuned and join us a little bit later for the second half of our show, as we have martial artist, actor, and stunt person Nick Palma joining us. So we'll get him on after this first segment. All right, well, let's get on with the show. Mexican porn star, oh, my God. All right, what do we got for birthdays on our friends list there, Bob?
On our friends list. Well, somebody reminded me it was her birthday tomorrow, and she lives in Southern California, and she is a judo practitioner. And that would be Natalia Oksana out of Southern California. Her birthday is tomorrow, the 14th. We have Amanda Law, relation to Amanda Hug and Kiss. Her birthday is on 4/15.
Sorry.
We have our good friend of the show, Masters Hall of Fame Ambassador, Angie Abad Mancia. Her birthday is on the 17th. We have somebody else who's been on our show for the Teaching Kids segment, Janet Gulliger. Her birthday is on 4/18. And Grandmaster and Cane Expert, Mark Shuey. His birthday is on 4/19. Those are my birthday shout-outs.
See, no, because I get to do it. I get to do it always. Sifu Bob was like, don't do it, don't do it. And I'm like, ah, it's too late now. We're live. What are you going to do? No, tomorrow, the 14th, April 14th, is going to be Sifu Bob's birthday, and you're going to be the big half century 50. Right on. Woo! So are you going to celebrate like all week? Because I know I would. I know
you
I
know,
will.
I'm going to try. I'm going to try. I'm going to try. I may be celebrating a lot alone, but that's okay. Sometimes when I'm a half century old, leave my ass alone. Don't talk to me. Don't come near me. I've got my bottle of tequila. Leave me alone. I'm good.
Yep. Bottle of tequila and a good cigar, and you're good to go.
Yep.
Right on. Well, I wish I could celebrate with you, but I'll be there in May, and we'll celebrate then. But you can just stick with the tequila, because I don't do tequila. Okay. Just something after I turn 40. I just don't do any hard liquor very well anymore.
You don't do hard liquor anymore. It does you.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, one shot and it's like, woo, I'm good. Just get me out of here. Wheelbarrow me out of here. All right. Yeah, that'll be a happy birthday. So happy birthday, everyone. And for everyone else that's having a birthday this week, this tune's for you. For the week of the 13th through the 19th, Amanda Law, Angie, Abad Mancia, Janet Goliger, Mark Shuey, and my buddy Sifu Bob Deal. Yay. All right. Let's move on to our shout-outs. What do we got for shout-outs? I'd like to see if do you have the information for Dragon Fest with you?
Of course. It's always up on my screen every Sunday.
Awesome. Well, let's go ahead and tell our listeners about Dragon Fest again. That'll be awesome.
Well, I'm going to change the format a little bit because I think, you know, I've announced every time I announce who's going to be there. Well, I'm going to talk more about the whole event this time.
Oh, good.
There has been some additions and subtractions, you know, people not confirming, people canceling, that sort of thing. And I found out somebody canceled and our guest from today is actually going to have a booth at Dragon Fest. The curator, the president of the museum, Michael Matsuda, has actually had to turn a lot of people away. Now, we were one of the first to sign up for a booth. As soon as he announced that it changed venues to the Holiday Inn, I went over and signed. And then people came by later, but he can't accept anymore. He's got like 68 booths right now. So
That's a lot.
It is a lot for a ballroom.
For a ballroom for the first time coming back, yeah.
Yeah, and he's at 200 tickets sold so far, but none locally because they don't need hotels or plane fares, so they don't care. So he's gotten everyone he's gotten so far from out of state, far out of state. He's gotten them from the East Coast, Texas. Jamie Cash is coming, which is an ambassador of the Masters Hall of Fame. He's out of Dallas-Fort Worth area, but nobody locally yet. He'll probably get a bum rush about 1 to 2 weeks from the event, and which is about 5 weeks from today. Get your tickets. Go to museumdragonfest.com. Get your tickets. Everybody who buys an online ticket will be given priority entrance. The deadline is going to be May 16th because your tickets have to be emailed to you. All the tickets I found out, I said, Michael, how are you going to monitor this? What prevents people from just local guys printing more than one ticket and just handing them out to their friends? Each ticket's going to be individually numbered.
Each
one will be checked in per that number. So they will see if duplicates come in, which is a very good thing. Tickets are $25 no matter what. if you buy them in advance or you buy them at the door, but please buy them in advance. Rusty and I are going to be warming up the audience prior to the event, like 12:30 or 12:15, because there's going to be a long line. We're going to have we're going to give out shirts. We're going to, you know, maybe run a trivia contest, give out these shirts, and the shirts will be provided by Tradition Shirts, which are the Wilson brothers, Don and James Wilson, will be providing the shirts for us to hand out. And we will be having a free raffle where we're going to be giving a couple baskets away and another shirt. It's going to be an amazing, amazing day. Michael showed me the layout the other day. Our booth switched a little bit because now we've got to be – I thought all those rooms – and I think he may not think about this, but all these rooms typically have outlets in the floor.
Oh, okay.
All I have to take a cover off, but he's putting everybody who requires power like us, because we're going to have, you know, a couple tablets, a couple cell phones, laptop, all that need to maintain charge during the 6 hours of Dragon Fest.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be on the wall possibly by registration. We
may not be
able to do a live show, because what's going to happen, Rusty, is every 15 minutes he's going to have a runner that goes and gets a different booth to come up to the stage and talk about what they do.
Oh.
And that's going to be very loud. It's going to be on an entire loudspeaker system. So instead of like we thought before where he was going to have a stage per area, now he's just going to have one stage for the whole thing. So these speakers have to be plastic.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
So
we
may be able to do what we did at Masters last year, just, you know, do some candid interviews and then put them together and put them on the next show.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm hoping for, is to maybe get some candid interviews with the people, you know, line in the queue trying to get in. Maybe some interviews and pictures with some of the other people in there, the vendors and the celebrities and stuff like that. It'll be cool. And then we'll air that show that Sunday if I can get everything. Oh, wait, hold on. It's on Sunday. That's right. I'll try to get that show out as a archived show and get that link out to everyone so that way people can listen to it and have fun with it. It'll be cool. So, yeah, get your tickets, folks. This is a fundraiser for the Martial Arts History Museum. So, you know what, Bob? I can't imagine that any self-respecting martial artist would print up a ticket and try to duplicate it and give it to their friends. So, you know, I can't imagine anyone doing that, but, you know, anybody else who just wants to come in and rub elbows, you know, that probably don't even do martial arts, maybe. I can see that happening.
Maybe.
But yeah, so people out there, if you're listening, yeah, you know, buy the tickets. They're only $25, and most cons, you know, like Comic-Con or Sakura-Con, one of, you know, those other specialty cons, it's going to cost you anywhere between $30 to $50 to get in. More than that if you want the whole weekend. So, you know, for a day at Dragon Fest with the best, you know, martial artists, vendors, and celebrities, you know, in the martial arts realm, you know, $25, go for it, people.
Awesome.
Right. Okay. Well, I want to do another plug for the Pacific Association of Women's Martial Artists Training Camp. It's going to be September 19th through the 22nd in Aldersgate Retreat in Turner, Oregon. And this particular organization, PAMA, because Pacific Association of Women's Martial Artists is too much to say, PAMA's been around since like 1970, I want to say, 8. I think, yeah, I might be wrong, give or take 5 years, but it's been around since 1973 or 1978. And is one of the oldest women's only martial arts organizations in the United States, if not the world. And this particular camp has been training women in many different martial arts. We have people not only from the United States coming to train and teach, but also from all over the world. We've had teachers come in from as far as Israel to come and teach for PAMA every year. So, you know, do take that into consideration. If you're in a co-ed school or even an all-women school, please think about coming to the camp, because this is different than, like, let's say co-ed camps, because it's taught by women for women only. And there's been talk for this year being completely man-free. Like, I was under the impression that we were thinking about, okay, let's open the demonstration and the social hour to anyone and everybody. But today at our board meeting, we were talking about, you know, should we have no men at all? And, you know, we're still kind of hashing it out because there are some women that do have a, you know, have a thing about it. It's their time, you know, that kind of thing.
I agree with that because if you do it once, Rusty, you're going to set a precedent.
Exactly. You know, pretty soon guys are going to start, you know, pretty soon trainers are going to ask to bring their husbands, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know.
Exactly. No. So if you never do it, nobody can ask because then you can say no and have a clear conscience.
Exactly. And this particular camp, we're trying to get, every year we try to get as many trainers that represent, you know, the whole gamut of martial arts categories like stand-up, grappling, weaponry, specialty weaponry, you know, even internal arts, meditation, or even just lectures about, you know, different ways to build your martial arts business and stuff like that. And this particular camp is open to any woman of any rank, even if you've never had previous experience, but you're interested in finding out what art would be for you, this is the camp to go to because, again, you know, we have so many different martial arts being represented every year. So, you know, spread the word. Pacific Association of Women's Martial Artists, their website is www.pawma.org. And just go there and there'll be lots more information about that. And this is open for women and girls ages 14 and above. All right. And I think I have one more shout-out. This shout-out is for Master Ron Kozakowski. He's having a Kung Tao seminar at his studio on Sunday, April 27th. Starts at 10:30 and goes until about 4:30 at Practical Self-Defense Training Center, PSDTC, at 847 Hamilton Avenue, and that's on Route 69 in Waterbury, Connecticut. There is going to be a lunch break, so he suggests for people to bring a lunch. And this seminar is primarily for people that are curious about Kung Tao, and it will be taught entirely by Ron Kozakowski. And even if you're familiar with Kung Tao or even practicing with it, you know, I do suggest checking it out with Master Ron. They're going to be going over stuff like, let's see here. Oh, he changed it. It used to have like what they were gonna go over, but oh well. Okay, this particular seminar for advanced registration, if you register by April 25th, the registration is only $55. That's it. $55. At the door, it's $65. Visa and MasterCard are accepted for registration, and you can also buy clothing or equipment there with Visa or MasterCard. You do want to check in between 9:30 and 10:15, and the workshop starts at 10:30 sharp. Make sure that you bring mouthpieces, eye protection, cups, and any other training weapons like sticks, knives, daggers, karambits, the whole nine yards. So just go to psdtc.com. And you can get more information about that. Again, that's PSDTC, Practical Self-Defense Training Center. All right. Very cool. And I think that's it for my shout-outs. Do you have any other shout-outs, Bob?
No, that's it.
Oh, I guess that's it. Well, right on. Well, I think it's time for health news. All right. Now, this is about juicing. Now, juicing has been around for a bit, and it's gotten pretty popular for what people tout as detoxing and a way of losing weight. So, yeah, you've heard of juicing, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, even like as far back as like Jack LaLanne, I shouldn't say as far back, that makes it sound like it's in the 1920s, but, you know, in the 1950s and 60s and stuff like that, Jack LaLanne was even a big supporter of the vegetables in a juice fashion and stuff like that. And if I remember correctly, he had his own juicer blender type thing. Do you remember? I think I could have sworn he did.
He does.
Yeah, he had a Jack LaLanne thing, and I think he still does. Is he still alive? I think he is.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
he's
gosh.
Like 95 or something, but yeah.
That's incredible. That's it, just totally incredible, and you see what fitness gets you. But nowadays, though, there's a little bit of controversy. You know, is it really a good detox, or is it a diet trap? Now, like I said earlier, a lot of people say that it's a great way to detox the body, prevent disease, and lose weight. And, you know, there's something appealing about being able to, like, mix up all these vegetables like kale and broccoli and stuff like that, you know, stuff that most people would probably never eat, mask them with the sweet taste of strawberries or blueberries or whatever, and bam, you get your vitamins without having to chow down on salad and rabbit food. I mean, how cool is that, you know?
That's very cool,
plus,
yeah.
It is cool. Plus, you get to tell everyone you're juicing, and it helps you look cool. But according to research, you just can't juice all day, every day. It's not something that you can live on and expect to stay healthy. So the experts first want to tell a little bit about the benefits of juicing. So here we go. A new research shows that eating up to 7 servings of fruit and vegetables a day can have a significant impact on your lifespan. Now, for those of us who don't have that kind of time to cut up or cook 2 servings with every meal, juicing is a great way to get your vegetables on the go. Now, a lot of people don't really like to eat fruits and vegetables. I know when I was like a kid, all the way up into my late teens, I hated fruits and vegetables. It was like McDonald's all the way, you know. However, you know, doing it in juice form gives people that kick of, hey, I'm doing something healthy, I'm doing something good for myself. And that's a very common psychological benefit, so says Gail Kenfield, and she's the director of nutrition for Pritkin Longevity Center. Now, juicing provides all the same vitamins, minerals, and phytonutrients as eating whole fruits and vegetables, and the water content can help you stay hydrated. Juicing is also a good way to use up any about to spoil produce, which means you're doing your part to stop food waste. Okay, so those are some of the benefits of juicing. Now, here's the thing. A lot of people think that juicing is low calorie, but to tell you the truth, it's not. It's not exactly. Now, it's low calorie compared to, like, McDonald's, right?
Yeah.
And because it's a very concentrated source of calories, and here's why. Okay, a cup of pineapple, for example, has about 83 calories. Okay, but a cup of pineapple juice, get this, is 120 calories. Go figure, right?
What?
An 8-ounce glass of orange juice may contain as many as 4 medium oranges because we're juicing it, right? So you're taking like the juice, if you take the juice out of the pulp or the meat, I guess, of the fruit, it substantially ups the calorie intake because of the amount that's needed to make the juice. So, you know, I mean, we have to kind of think about that. You know, would I sit down and eat 4 oranges in one sitting? Well, I have at one point, but I have a few times, but most people won't, right? But
right.
You could sure down that glass of juice in fewer than 5 minutes. So, you know, you're getting a little more calories than you would as if you ate the whole fruit and vegetables. Now, because the juicing actually makes the content of the fruit more concentrated, so is the sugar content of that fruit. So another example, a cup of pomegranate juice, for example, has about 37 grams of sugar compared to just 12 grams in a cup of whole pomegranate seeds. Wow, right?
Yeah,
so
big difference.
12 grams versus 37 grams. Now, it's said that consuming your food in liquid form may also leave you feeling less fulfilled, meaning you'll probably eat more calories than you would if you just simply chewed the food.
Right,
now,
right.
Now, will it help people detox? Now, let's clear up a little bit about what detoxing is, because a lot of people have like different definitions of it. So let's go back to what your organs do and why we have to detox. Now, your organs, particularly your liver and your kidneys and your immune system, already do a lot of work to rid your body of toxins and stuff like that. Now, according to dietitian Deborah Levy, she says there's nothing in medical literature to affirm that the body needs an outside source to cleanse itself. However, some people say juicing helps them transition to healthier habits. So it's worth a shot of juice. So now for people that do want to use it for a cleanse, okay, I've had a lot of people that do juicing for a cleanse, like a colon cleanse or whatever. Ms. Levy recommends that you only do a cleanse for 3 days. Anything more than that, then your body will start to go into starvation mode and you're doing like more harm than good. And she guards against going on an all juice diet because you want to be balanced with protein also and everything else. You know, you need a little bit of dairy, protein, whole grains, fruits, vegetables, and fats. And, you know, and some foods just don't juice properly. So, you know, like fish or whole bread, it says here. Who would juice a fish? I just read this. Oh, my God.
Who would juice bread?
Oh, my gosh. It says some foods don't juice properly, like fish.
Yeah. No kidding.
Oh, my gosh. But I'll make this real quick, folks, okay? Now, when you actually juice something, you are technically mechanically pulverizing it. And when you do that in a blender or a juicer or whatever, you're separating the fiber from the juice. So you are not getting that fiber that your body needs. And fiber helps you regulate your blood sugar levels. So, you know, it's a lot better to just eat the whole fruit. But you know what? If you do want to do the juicing, go for it. You'll still get your vitamins and minerals. But just remember, it's not going to be necessarily less calories or less sugar. And if you're going to use it for a cleanse, 3 days max, don't go any more than that. Okay, I've heard of people going on a 30-day juice fast, and they lose weight, yeah. But, you know, it really screws up your body, and you end up gaining that weight back when you start transitioning to real food. So, you know, just live a balanced life, you guys. Stay out of stress, eat healthy, and you'll be fine. Whew. All right, so much for that. Because I actually thought about doing a juice fast just to, like, get rid of a couple pounds and just kind of start from there, you know, to get back into the fitness thing. Because I've just lately in the last month started getting back into just serious, hardcore, you know, intense workouts and stuff. And, you know, I spent the last 2 months slowly working my way up to it. And I've already lost, like, 2 pounds. But I thought, you know, maybe I should go on a juice, you know, lose another 2 or 3 pounds and then just go from there. But now after reading all this and knowing that fiber regulates your blood sugar levels, I don't think I will, because I'm, you know, too grumpy anyway when my blood sugar drops. I don't want to do that again. Why would I want to, like, drop my blood sugar? So, anyway, all right, let's get into
Weird News.
There it is. There it is.
I had to go shut my bedroom door because my daughter and my wife were fighting.
Oh, that's... Oh, no.
That's, yeah, that can get real ugly.
Yeah.
Well, this is funny. Have you ever seen a show called The World's Dumbest Criminals?
Yes, I love it.
One time... I saw a show where a guy went to rob a convenience store with a blade.
Mm-hmm.
He got up to the counter, drew his blade, went to rob it. There was a uniformed cop standing behind him in line.
Just goes to show that some crooks just don't have a sense of awareness about them, do they?
No kidding. So this is sort of along those lines.
Okay.
Two Minnesota burglary suspects are arrested after police say one of them accidentally called 911 and left the line open as the pair discussed the crime.
And I bet this is what they said.
No, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, when they're taking off in cuffs. Maplewood Police Chief Paul Schnell says the dispatcher got a call and hang up. Then another call that stayed open. The St. Paul Pioneer Press reports the dispatcher overheard a conversation about where police were. Schnell says the calls were made on April 1st using the phone's emergency call feature. The dispatcher saw the location was a car repair shop. Officers arrived to see two men leaving the building wearing dark clothing, one carrying a television set, the other a box. The other was carrying a box, probably a toolbox, something like that. The men dropped the object and ran, but were caught by police dogs. 32-year-old Todd Weiss of Minnetonka and 38-year-old Justin Evans are charged with third-degree burglary. Amazing.
Oh, my God.
You see, they are insane.
Yeah.
No lie.
Oh, my gosh. What a bunch of idiots. You know, they need to find a new job after they get out of jail. But anyway.
Yes. And here is our entertainment news.
Entertainment.
Justin Bieber's always in the news. He's always
news
doing something. Punking strippers or drunk or drugs or Selena Gomez. This one's actually kind of funny.
Okay. Okay.
It seems, what? It seems Justin Bieber's, because have you heard about the trouble he had in his neighborhood? He egged some guy's house and did a bunch of stuff, and a petition was flying out to try to get him to move. Well, now he's in Calabasas, which is about 20 miles from me. Okay? His intentions were he was going to sell his house and get out of Dodge.
Mm-hmm.
So, it seems Justin Bieber's intentions to sell the California mansion will have to wait a bit since it's rumored the singer owes $85,000 to repair damage to the property still.
We doubt that
amount will make a difference for the buyer. But, now, if you're familiar with construction at all, when you sign a contract with a contractor, he will put a pre-lien on your house.
Mm-hmm.
That means if you don't pay him, he will put a full lien on your house, which prevents you from selling it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't sell it until he's paid off. And that's where Justin Bieber is right now.
Wow.
Fortunately for the singer's neighbors, Bieber left his Calabasas home in January and settled down in Atlanta for numerous conflicts with police in the California gated community. The police were always at this guy's house.
Jeez.
All the time. Justin's been criticized for his loud parties, reckless driving through the neighborhoods, and assaulting a neighbor's house with eggs, which I just mentioned. Now, this next statement is absolutely driving me insane. According to reports, you'll have to listen to this very carefully, and I may repeat it because it's going to bear repeating.
Okay.
According to reports, TV star, air quotes, Khloe Kardashian bought the property for $7.2 million. What's the part that doesn't make sense? TV star, Khloe Kardashian.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? Are you insane?
Oh, gosh. Well, wait a minute. If he still owes, then how can she buy it if he owes $85,000 to the construction people? I mean, isn't his house on pre-lien?
It is. So, and after that, after it says she bought it for $7.2 million, but their contract cannot be valid until Bieber pays off what he owes for repairs.
Okay.
Bosses in a construction company stated they carried out $85,000 worth of repairs in Bieber's home, but the singer still hasn't paid the bill after the executives have filed legal papers. TMZ reports the contract will be void if the troubled singer still hasn't paid his bill by next week.
Wait, you mean the contract between Khloe Kardashian and Bieber?
Okay.
Man, I mean, come on, Justin. Stop being
a
Bieber baby and pay your bill.
What was it? A couple weeks ago when I said something about him walking into a strip club with $71,000 in ones?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He could have almost paid the bill with that.
Yeah, I know. If he can, go into a strip club with $71,000 in $1 bills, he can pay off a bunch of hardworking construction people that, like, repaired his messed up mansion. Come on. Like I said earlier, Justin, stop being a Bieber baby. Pay your bill. Pay the bill. Come on. Jeez, stuff like that just, like, makes me want to vomit. But, gee whiz, that just, I don't know how celebrities do it. Like, the celebrities that, like, you know, stay on the good side of the public eye, you know, I don't know how they do it. You know, then you've got other celebrities that, you know, don't even know what they're spending.
You know? Yeah, no kidding, right?
Yeah.
And then, then you've got people that like Charlie Sheen, that absolutely screwed up. Drugs,
yeah.
Alcohol, beating up hookers, whatever he went through, he always has and always will get a pass.
Yeah, yeah.
He can't do anything wrong. It doesn't matter what he does.
I don't get it.
It's like remember when Ellen came out about 10 years ago and announced that she was gay? That
mm-hmm.
killed her show. That
mm-hmm.
one statement got her off the air. Now she bounced back. But
mm-hmm.
after she came out like that, her show was canceled within 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. And then Charlie Sheen can go out and get drunk and punch out somebody, and he's fine. You know?
He spends $50,000 on hookers. He's
yeah.
great. He's golden.
Yeah. It makes no sense to me how
no.
Well, number one, and I just want to, like, get this out here before we go into the next part so we can get to our guests, because stuff like this drives me insane, folks. You know, number one, if you're going to be, a celebrity, I mean, you do have to, like, you know, watch how you act in public and stuff, but you also want to be who you are. I mean, kudos to Ellen for coming out, right? Because she could have just, like, hit it, you know, but and left people guessing and wondering, and I'm sure people were wondering, right? I mean, they had to have been, right? But on the other hand, you know, what makes someone's show all of a sudden, in Ellen's case, what makes her show all of a sudden less than watchable just because she says she's gay? You know, don't get
because
me started with
that.
The whole religious Bible busting type of stuff. Don't get me started with that, because I will.
Well, honestly, Rusty, at that point in time, because it was still the 90s, I think we were just less tolerant
mm-hmm.
at the time.
Yeah, I think so. And it's funny how the public will view a celebrity once they get their bubble burst about how that celebrity is. And all of a sudden that celebrity is a ne'er-do-well and can't do anything right and, you know, get her off the air, blah, 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 right? But,
and now
you
she's making like $50 million a year.
Exactly, right? She's like running head-to-head with Oprah. It's great.
Right.
Go, Ellen. All right. So last but not least, before we take a short break, is going to be our brain teaser of the week. So this is a weekly contest. So listeners, listen up. If you're the first caller with the first correct answer to this brain buster, you get to win a chance to be a guest co-host with me and Sifu Bob, or you get to be a guest, or you can suggest a guest. And if we get that guest on the air, you can join us to be a co-host. So listen up, and here is the brain buster of the week. All right, riddle me this. Listen up, everyone. This is kind of weird. Okay. I am small as an ant and as big as a whale. I can soar through the air like a bird with a tail. I can be seen by day and not by night. I can be seen with a big flash of light. I follow whoever controls me by the sun, but I fade away when dark fell like a ton. What am I? So I'm going to go ahead and post this on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page because it is in poem fashion. So answer it there. Go to the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show Facebook page, and I just posted it. You'll get the whole riddle there. And if you're the first correct answer, you get to be a co-host with me and Sifu Bob. It'll be fun. All right. Well, let's do this. Let's go ahead and take a short break. We're actually going to play music for this one. It'll be about a 4-minute break. And in the meantime, we're going to contact our guest, Mr. Nick Palma, martial artist, stunt person, and actor. And if you want to call in and say hello to Nick or have questions for him, our phone number is 347-677-0699. We also have a chat board underneath the Blog Talk Radio marquee. So if you're listening live on Blog Talk Radio and you actually have the marquee, not just listening on Facebook, just scroll down a little bit. You'll find our chat board, and you can go ahead and ask your questions there. So we'll be right back in about 4 minutes.
What the future holds. Try and keep your head up to the sky. Lovers, they may cause you tears. Go ahead, release your fears. Stand up and be counted. Don't be ashamed to cry. You gotta be bad. You gotta be bold. You gotta be wiser. You gotta be hard. You gotta be tough. You gotta be stronger. You gotta be cool. You gotta be calm, you gotta stay together. All I know, love will save the day. Herald what your mother said, read the books your father read. Try to solve the puzzles in your own sweet time. Some may have more cash than you, others take a different view.
Talk Radio with Restita and Robert. We're broadcasting live from Seattle, Washington on the Seika Network on blogtalkradio.com. So our phone number here is 347-677-0699. If you have any questions or our special guest tonight, feel free to give us a call or give us a type in the chat board on the Blog Talk Radio show marquee. All right. How you doing, Bob? You doing great?
I'm doing good. I'm doing real well.
Awesome. Well, why don't we go ahead and get started with the second portion of the show? So I'm going to give the mic to you, Bob.
Cool. Now, let me finish what I'm saying before everybody starts texting Rusty and going, God, your co-host is very disrespectful. I don't mean to be, but this is how Nick came across to me. A friend of mine and I were talking at the Martial Arts History Museum, and I understand Nick is actually a freak of nature. He doesn't just do one-handed push-ups. This guy does one-thumb push-ups.
Oh, that's awesome.
He can do things that are impossible. He is a writer, an actor, a stuntman. He is the original Michelangelo, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle in the original movies. Please help me welcome, with a round of applause, Mr. Nick Palmer to the show. Welcome, Nick.
Hi, Robert. How are you? Hello, Restita. How are you?
Doing
okay. You're breaking up.
I don't know what happened
She's
to my applause. I'm breaking
okay.
up, but oh well. Okay.
That's
We're good.
Okay, but, okay. Well, kawabunga, I'm so happy to be here with you guys on Dynamic Dojo Talk Radio today.
Woo!
Yes, sirree. How you guys doing? So anyway, what do you guys... Oh. What do you guys do? What are you guys about? What's the radio show?
Oh. There's my applause. Okay.
All right. Very cool.
My computer's being, like, glitchy right now. I don't know what's going on, but, yeah,
it's
so,
right.
Again,
was
your computer glitchy, too?
Actually, mine's talking back to me. I don't know about yours, Bob.
Oh. Not supposed
to
be.
I have a wife that does that.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Okay. Well, Nick, again, thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today. And for our listeners out there, give us a call, 347-677-0699. If you have any questions about stunts or stunt fighting for film or getting into the industry or his martial arts experience, just give us a call, 347-677-0699. Now, Nick, what we normally like to do to get our listeners familiar with our guests is if we could have you tell our listening audience a little bit about your martial arts experience and how you got into martial arts, that would be awesome.
Oh, yeah, there you bet. This is going to be going down memory lane for me, but for
awesome.
Sure. Okay. Well, here, it all started, well, I hate to age myself, but 40 years ago, it actually started when I went to see the premiere of Enter the Dragon at the age of 13.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys can do the math. But anyway, to be quite honest, I didn't make the connection between Bruce Lee and the Green Hornet in Kato, although I had seen the Green Hornet and was very excited about it. It wasn't until 1973 when I went to see the premiere of Enter the Dragon, my friend and I, and my big brother, that I was thoroughly changed forever. I mean, Bruce Lee jumped out of that screen at me, and and countless of other people, too, by the way. But after that, the next week, I was in a martial arts school. It could have been any martial arts school. I would not have known the difference at the time. It just so happened to be a kung fu style by the name of Choi Li Foot. Kung Fu, which is a Southern Chinese style. And I actually jumped into classes. A friend of mine took me to this teacher who taught out of his garage by the name of Jimmy Ming Wong.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happened, that I started there with my older brother. And basically, Jimmy Ming Wong eventually changed his name to, today we know him as Master Doc Fai Wong.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually started with him in the garage of his house in the Sunset District of San Francisco. Of course, I wanted to be Bruce Lee, who didn't. So during that course at that time, I was also, I saw the limitations of learning the Kung Fu style. I mean, as not really limitations, only at the beginning stage is what I'm saying, the beginner's level. But I was at a beginner's mind anyway. So I tried to take other forms just to try to be Mr. Versatility, which was Bruce Lee. So I ended up boxing, wrestling, got a book out of the library and learned gymnastics on my own so that I could, you know, be the next Bruce Lee. Lo and behold, as years went by, I stayed with Doc Bai Wong for 7 years. And during that course, I've also boxed at Newman's Gym, which was in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, under the guidance of this old, at the time, he was like 74 years old, but his name was Johnny Carnation Vidal. He was a fantastic, excellent coach. He took me to two Golden Gloves that I won. One was in 1978 at the weight of 112 pounds. Yes, I know, a fly, you know, I ate a little bit more because next year I ended up going up a little more, and I ended up winning that 1981. Actually, 1978 was 106. So 2 years later, I won the 1980 Golden Gloves as well at 112 pounds. So I did eat a little bit more during dinner. I ate those vegetables as well, kids. But, so that's how I got started with that. And of course, during that time, I was also in college. So that was like, for me, college was, if you will, my Shaolin temple. In other words, I ended up, you know, I went to school to become an architect initially, but that later changed into I was in pretty much every physical activity I can get into. In other words, I wrestled, I did soccer, I took fencing, you know, I did gymnastics and under the guidance of coaches, but they were all, you know, physical education classes, weightlifting and so forth. So I was able to hone my skills in different areas. And, you know, I just basically, that was my Shaolin temple in the sense that I developed the physical attributes and the versatility that I would later need to become a stunt person or in action movies and so forth. And then basically in 1982, I joined the U.S. Army. Yep. I wasn't really getting anywhere. Yeah, well, I wasn't getting anywhere at Harvard on the Hill, which we called it, which was basically City College of San Francisco. So I ended up jumping into the Army and reaping their benefits, which was, you know, the home benefits, the educational benefits, which I would later use in the future. But I ended up, my first duty station was in Korea, South Korea. And I ended up in the, not the DMZ, I was down about 50 miles from that, which a place called Camp Casey, the 2nd Infantry Division, Indian Head was their logos, basically. So so there I ended up starting, you know, I kind of boxed in the unit. They were getting ready for this, what they call the Indian Head Olympics when I got there, and I decided, you know, I'd get involved with their boxing tournament there. They had a boxing division, so I ended up boxing for them at 119 pounds, and to be quite honest, when I went out to meet my opponent, he actually gave me a pretty good right that sent me to the ground. I was pretty woozy. But to be quite honest, that actually woke me up because I came up and then he couldn't touch me again because I basically TKO'd him in the 2nd round, I believe. So I won that. Yeah, I was pretty happy, believe me, because I actually, when he hit me, I saw myself fall so slow. In slow motion. But
oh,
I got
man.
Up. But I needed that hit, Restita, because I needed that hit because that actually woke me up. And so I came back, as I said, and I won that tournament. And then I won another tournament down in Seoul, Korea, which was down about 25 miles from where we were. And I actually won that one as well. That was actually an exhibition bout. It was during the winter, a Christmas exhibition. Mm-hmm. And again, an exhibition bout, you know, being a martial artist, for both of you, that you just exhibit your skills. You don't really try to hurt each other.
Mm-hmm.
Well, someone didn't tell the other opponent that he was, you know, he was trying to take my head off left and right. I know, and that it was that kind of fight. But so basically, I just came back and I actually stopped him as well, and I won that one as well by TKO, so, which was. Goodness gracious, thank goodness, because it was either him or me at that point. But,
wow.
You know, yeah, it was exciting times. Actually, my coach there was none other than, and you may not, you perhaps remember this guy, he was on the 1977 Olympic team with Sugar Ray Leonard. The Olympics went back then with Sugar Ray Leonard. His name was Charles Mooney. He won the silver medal at the Olympics for the 119 pounds. He was actually my coach up in the 2nd Infantry Division at Camp Casey. So I was, you know, it was an honor to meet him. He really gave me some great, advice and techniques at that time, and which I use to this day as well. And along with Johnny Carnation and Ed Mullins was another guy that actually helped me as well. And they were just fantastic guidance in that respect, as well as my Sifu, Doc Fai Wong, and all the other teachers that I had the privilege of learning, you know, bits and pieces of the puzzle to my life with. Let's see. And basically, the second half, I was there in Korea for 1 year. The second half of that year, I decided, you know, then Choi Foot, are you familiar with that style, which is a southern kung fu style?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've never studied it, but I'm familiar
Southern Chinese martial arts focus on, you know, strong horse stances, low kicks, very little kicks, to be honest, more hand techniques and animal techniques and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So needless to say, my hands were great, not only from the Choi Li Foot, but from the boxing as well. But my kicking ability was not really developed to the extent where I could use it at will. And mm-hmm. so I decided to take up Taekwondo in Korea. And it was nice because I, of course, there was that language barrier, which was, you know, a horrible thing for me. But they were located on the post where I was located at, so it wasn't too far to go away. I was actually across the street in a little barracks that I ended up, you know, took up Taekwondo there. I trained my butt off and developed those kicks to the ability that eventually I was able to go to the Kukiwong, which is in Seoul, Korea, to test for the black belt before I left Korea. So I did get that first degree black belt from the Kukiwong in Seoul. And that was, you know, a really great thing. But that also gave me the opportunity to develop my kicking ability. So now I was more versatile in the sense that my hands and feet were now great weapons of mine. I really enjoyed that. They had even asked if I would stick around in Korea to kind of travel throughout Korea and kind of, you know, just go to different tournaments. But I was too homesick, and I needed to get back home to the United States. So I declined, and I just went to my next duty station. But I continued at the next duty station to continue with Muay Thai, actually, this time. But it was still a form of hard-style external martial art through Santa Maria. Actually, his name is, Santa Maria, which was in Killeen, Texas. So I went to Fort Hood for about 10 months there, and I got some guidance under that. Yeah, which is very, very good martial art as well. So, you know, I mean, I just kind of slowly picked it up. Being in the infantry, you know, the main thing about being on the battlefield or any battlefield is versatility. Are you able to adapt as a, you know, as a soldier, as a martial artist, as a human being, I guess, even in life? I mean, we come up in obstacles that will prevent us from reaching our goals. Well, can we overcome that? Can we get around? And so adaptability is is essential. And so I got into Muay Thai there, and I also did a little wrestling back at City College. So I did a little bit of wrestling, but I didn't really like it at the time, and this was maybe 18 years old. It was a little too rough actually for me, believe it or not, but eventually I picked it up again, and I became pretty good at even wrestling, so that gave me, you know, the ability as well. So it kind of goes with the whole Bruce Lee philosophy. Again, I'm still trying to develop that versatility of Bruce Lee, and that means, you know, he always talked about be like water, you know, take the path of least resistance and be able to adapt into any situation. And my motto was always, to a point and to a certain age group, always ready was my motto, be always ready. And of course, the physical is extremely important, but what kind of controls your physical is the mind. So that's another aspect that I needed to develop, which I hadn't really addressed to a certain point in my life. And I think it was after the Army that I started to develop that, you know, I realized, see, things came really fast for me physically. Even the thumb push-ups, I mean, after, I have to be quite honest, when I saw Bruce Lee in 1973, the next week. Again, I was in that martial arts school, and then I kind of consumed everything of Bruce Lee, his, you know, magazines, posters. They were all plastered over my, you know, like anybody else, thousands of other youths at that time. And I happened to open one magazine one time, and I saw him do his two-finger, one-arm push-ups and his thumb push-ups. Well, I had to do that. So I started doing them. And to be quite honest, the first time I did it, I kind of snapped my thumbs. It took perseverance. Yeah, well, eventually, you know, he did them with open hands. But he developed that. So in other words, I started to do that, but then they just snapped on me. The weight of my body snapped my thumbs. Yeah. And then I just let them rest, and I came back, and I started to close my fist to strengthen the tendon in the thumb itself. And slowly but surely, eventually, I started to be able to open up the hand, and I eventually got the thumb push-ups and the two-finger, one-arm push-ups. And this was at the age of 15. So at that time, I had a couple of friends that I kind of started to demonstrate them at their tournament, which is the Navarros. I don't know if you're familiar with the Kempo Karate. Navarros in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Carlos Navarro, Frankie Navarro, which is his son, was a good friend of mine in school, and so that's how that came about. But back to my martial arts experience is, so getting out of the Army, and this is at 25, 1985, I took the benefits of it was called the VEAP program, which is Veterans Educational Assistance Program. I had put $100 a month in while I was on active duty for 3 years, and the United States Army gave me $200, so they would give me 2-to-1 basically. So I had the money to go to school, and being in the Army gave me an appreciation for civilian life. And you know what I mean? I mean, it was taken away from me, and I actually, you know, I went in there by myself. But once that was freedom was taken away, I really appreciated, you know, it more when I got out. So I ended up going back to San Francisco State University to finish up my BA, which was in physical education, which was human movement studies or kinesiology. So I went to San Francisco State University with that. At the same time, I told the Army that I would like to become an officer, because at the time, for the 3-year active duty, I was an enlisted man. And so I went through an ROTC program, which is Reserves Officers Training Candidate Program, mm-hmm. through the University of San Francisco. So there were two separate universities that I went to. Basically, military science was at USF, and my BA was at San Francisco State University. Anyway, I ended up getting my second lieutenant officer's bar, a butter bar, in 1987, and I received my BA from San Francisco State in 1988. So that's mm-hmm. where I got that. But back to the military, back to my martial arts training, as soon as I got out in 1985 from active duty, I continued my studies in Choi Li Foot. Now, being tutelaged in Choi Li Foot under Doc Fai Wong was great, but Doc Fai Wong, and I was a 13-year-old kid when I first started with him, being tutelaged by him, I mean, he's a great guy, and I still respect him, and I know him now. But at the time, we had a love-hate relationship, because at the time, as a martial arts teacher teaching kung fu, that was your main focus. There was no, you know, learning outside of the system. And mm-hmm. so I was one of those guys who didn't obey the rule, and so we just had a love-hate relationship. But as soon as I got out of the military, I ended up going to another Choi Li Foot teacher by the name of E.Y. Lee. E.Y. Lee was a senior student of Lao Bun, who was in Chinatown, who was basically ran the oldest kung fu school in the United States. It was Lao Bun School of Choi Li Foot. And so I stayed with now E.Y. Lee was, him and I kind of got together and kind of got interested in each other because of the fact that I was searching, basically. But he gave me extremely good guidance at that time, because I needed him to get me to the next level in my life. But his background was in, he had won San Francisco Mr. San Francisco in the 50s. You know, he's a bodybuilder type of guy. And he also did the Dragon Head and the Chinatown Parade. But he also is the only guy that I know that worked with John Wayne in Blood Alley. So he was in that movie as an extra. So we were able to kind of relate in that respect, too, because movies were my thing, too, after Enter the Dragon as well. Mm-hmm. But I stayed with him a couple of years, went to a tournament where I did actually fared very well. It was a tournament put on by Lai Hung. I don't know if he's another 20-foot Sifu that's in the Chinese community there. And he would hold these tournaments up in UC Davis to get a team together to go to Taiwan to fight every year. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just happened to be actually in Chinatown. One of this tournament, it was a Saturday, and I didn't know how to get there. I didn't have any means to get to UC Davis, which is about 90 miles away from San Francisco, because at that time I didn't have a car. I'm walking around Chinatown, and then I bump into this other Sifu who's a master of, his name is George Zhu, who's a master of the Qin mm-hmm. style of Kung Fu. Some of the students, you know him, yes. So some of the students were going to go. George was there, and I knew George from my Sifu, E.Y. Lee, because at one point we met in the Golden Gate Park. They kind of were teaching out of the Golden Gate Park at this time. So anyway, George says, well, my student can take it. I go, well, great. I'm getting to get there. Maybe it's in the cards for me. So I end up going. We weigh him, and then I have my first fight. And there's two bouts that I have to fight. Okay, so the first fight, and it's on my website, too, if anybody wants to see it, which is, you know, www.nickpalma.com. But the first fight is it's laid out in the school gym on these wrestling mats. And it's against his taller opponent, but I think he's not as versed, so he's not a veteran. He's probably a novice martial artist and probably maybe younger as well. But he's a lot taller, so it's kind of like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar against, you know, Bruce Lee or something like that. But we go at it. And I kind of handled him with no ease. I was in good shape. I had just come out of the Army, and I was running 5 miles a day to and from, you know, where I had to go to school. I kept that, you know, Army philosophy with me. And so I beat him easily, basically. But then I had another – and here's the thing, too, Restita, mm-hmm. is the referee was Lai Hung, the Sifu Lai Hung. So, you know, you've been to tournaments like that. I don't know if you have or not, but – I was fighting two opponents at that time. In any case, my final fight, which was against this guy, Tim Wong, which I believe was Lai Hung's, one of his top students, we went at it. And that's where the second fighter came in. In other words, that's when the referee would kind of stop me from actually getting the points that I needed. And eventually, and called me on this, called me on that, and eventually I got disqualified from that fight. So he gave the fight to his fighter, and the Sifus that were there, I think, and this I have to find out, but at the time they were trying to get together a Northern California Kung Fu Association, but anyway, they were all kind of protesting that fight, and I just kind of went on with my life and did other things. Eventually leaving Charlie Foote and getting into Wing Chun under Eddie Chung. And Wing Chun, being a unique martial arts style, also a Southern style, kind of took everything that I had learned up to that point and threw it out the window in the sense, and I had to kind of reshape myself into being a Wing Chun-ist. Can I ask you a question? Robert and Restita, what are your martial arts backgrounds, really quickly?
Sure. Go ahead, Bob. I'll start with you.
Well, you and I cut some of the same dirt, Nick. I was Wing Chun under Randy Williams, Mark Stewart, Ted Lukai, and I was JKD Collie under Mark Stewart and Ted Lukai.
Wow, very cool. That's exciting. Jeez. Yeah, we are. And Rasita, are you karate or?
Well, I did do karate. I don't actively teach it now. I did Botokukan karate since I was 8. I haven't actively taught Botokukan karate since 1994. I'm also a Kajikenbo and one-hop kendo stylist under Sifu Aldo Cascos and Sifu, Terry Faircloth. And I'm a Chen-style Tai Chi practitioner under Chen Zhengli from Chen Village in China, direct descendant from the Chen family. I'm also a Wushu instructor under my teacher, Sifu Yijiao Hong, and a Qigong instructor under her also. What else do I do? Oh, I do Doce Pares Escrima under Grandmaster Kakwai Kanyete, and kind of like a hybrid mix of Doce Pares and Inosanto Kali Silat under Grandmaster Christopher Petrilli. So,
good.
Pretty fun stuff.
It is. It sounds like, who's who yourself. So, being a martial artist, obviously in life, it's a journey. In other words, you can learn the basics in something, but life is full of different dimensions and forces, and it's just nice to, and I guess as a martial artist or a person, in order to realize life itself, you have to live it and experience it. So that's what, basically what I have been doing is, and I'm sure Bruce Lee and every other person that learns a martial art, eventually it becomes their own experience in that, as they, understand life and life understands them and, just how you really bring it about. But that's funny because, during the course of my life, I grew up with a lot of people like the Navarros, like I said, like Frankie Navarro was, and Rick Alamany, his stepson, Lou Altamirano, and Philip Wong of Wushu. I don't know if you're familiar with Philip, but he was a good friend of mine as well. Just growing up and being in the university, I met all these different guys. David Ross, which does Tai Chi, is very big right now. Mm-hmm. He's always really smart, but I was always a fighter. You know what I mean? I was in great form. I liked the actuality, and I guess I needed it because I was a smaller guy, and people actually, even to this day, I haven't grown much since, and don't tell anybody, since I was 13.
Neither have I.
But the fact is being small, people view you differently than they would if you had a bigger presence. In any case, I guess I actually had to do things. The funny about the Inosanto, and also during the course of my martial arts, I ended up leaving. Once I got my degrees, I ended up deciding that, I wanted to pursue my childhood dream, which was being in movies. And I had actually been introduced to movies, when I was 8 years old. I was in a couple of family shorts that my second cousin kind of started. He was like 6 years older than us. And then when I was 10 and 11 and 12, after seeing Planet of the Apes and being inspired by that, and then Enter the Dragon, me and my friends, we got together our own little film studio and started shooting our own, action movies. And then also when I was 18, this was a big thing. I got the opportunity to be in my first actual movie, and that was a low budget movie, but it was being filmed in the Bay Area, in the East Bay, and again through my friend the Navarros, actually Frankie, they got me the audition, and I went to Sid Campbell's school. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with? Okay, Sid Campbell was a great guy. I loved the guy, and God bless him. May he rest in peace. He was a fantastic guy. I didn't know him at the time, but I knew the Navarros, so we went to their school. I auditioned. I happened to get a part as an extra in the movie. And that movie was, and you guys may know it, Weapons of Death with Eric Lee.
Oh,
a little So you have Eric Lee, you have Gerald Okamura, you have Jenny Lau, you have all, these who's who in the martial arts world converging in the East Bay. And I am going to be working on this movie, my first break. Wow, this is it. And Paul Kiriati was the, producer and the writer and so forth, a great guy as well. And so, this was happening in 1978 when I was 18, back and forth. We traveled from San Francisco to the East Bay to finish this movie. And so when I did finish that movie, they had a big luau, everything was cool, and I ended up meeting Al DeCosco. I ended up meeting Ernie Reyes Sr. Mm-hmm. and a the young little 11-year-old Ernie Reyes Jr. Mm-hmm. And so, and then at that time, and this was in, I think it was Fremont or Oakland, but it's just funny how he went on to Hollywood, which is great, and he's a fantastic kid, and but now a young man and so forth. But anyway, so I left that, did my martial arts, did my schooling, did my military. In 1989, I decided, you know what, I'm going to move down to L.A., and I'm going to pursue that goal, because I still wanted to do that, and I just didn't know how I was going to do it, but I know I still wanted to do that. Packed up my stuff, still kept in touch with Eric Lee all those years, and mm-hmm. so Eric had a house out in Woodland Hills. He was renting rooms out of his house. He offered me the opportunity by saying, well, I can rent you a room out of my house. Come on down, and let's see what you can do. I did that. I ended up being in his house, and this was in Woodland Hills, California. Mm-hmm. Didn't have any means, and so I ended up working what I was doing before the Army, which was checking at a Safeway, checking and bagging and stuff like that.
Oh, uh-huh.
I worked for Lucky's and did the same thing. And so anyway, one day we went to Black Belt Magazine, which is in Burbank, Bob, and we were sitting down talking about some nice projects, writing projects for Eric, articles about Eric. And Eric talked to them, and he says, well, this is my friend, Nick Palma. He's from San Francisco. He was in my movie, Weapons of Death, and he wants to get into movies. And he goes, well, mm-hmm. what has he done? And I compiled a small resume, which was the only thing on it was actually I did a play senior year at Reardon High School, Fiddler on the Roof, where I played a Russian dancer, Sasha. And the mm-hmm. second one was Eric Lee's movie, Weapons of Death. And so I had that. I had my training and all my stuff that I had done up to that point. And then I had my contact. And then I had gotten a small little, a photo, an 8x10 photo of myself, which is your calling card. But here's the thing. I have always been, I don't want to say shy of the camera. I think I have been, but I'm slowly getting over it. But I gave him the best look I could give. Anyway, they told me that there is this one stunt coordinator and one movie, one project, and they're looking for this last turtle. And mm-hmm. And you know what? I'm looking at your resume, the person said, and he says, well, you're about the right height. You got a lot of the same skills they're looking for. This is the stunt coordinator's name. His name was Pat Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And we know Pat Johnson from the Karate Kid movies.
Karate Kid, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, and Enter the Dragon as well. And I'm just glad I never saw that guy in a black alley, by the way. But anyway, he's a great guy, but he looks mean as heck. but anyway, I compiled my photo and resume. I put it in a, envelope and so forth, and they gave me his address, which was there in the valley where I live. Put it in his mailbox, and I think we went Monday to the Black Belt, offices, the magazine offices, and then Tuesday I put it in his mailbox. Thursday I get a call from Pat Johnson. He looked over my resume and photo, and he goes, "Well, can you meet me tomorrow in Santa Monica at this name escapes me. Only perhaps you can remember Bob or Restita." And that is he's Hapkido from the Billy Jack movie.
Oh, Bong Soo-hong?
Yes, Bong Soo-hong on Santa Monica Boulevard. He had his dojo there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so we meet there on Friday. When I actually jumped back a day, Wednesday, Pat called me and asked me to go Thursday. So I go down this Thursday. And I do a little small audition, throw some kicks, do the nunchucks, do some flips and stuff like that. In front of Pat Johnson, the producers, which is Roberta Chow, Golden Harvest, and also David Chan of Golden Harvest, and then the writers and some other people that were very important, but their names escape me at the moment. And then so then they kind of have a little powwow. They talk it over. They come back to me and they say, get ready, because tomorrow you're going to London. You're going to fly to London. We're going to pick you up at this time, take you to the airport. You're going to fly to the Jim Henson office in London. This is England, by the way. And mm-hmm. so, I'm already, my head's jumping through the roof. I'm so excited. But I cannot show this. I didn't show it, but I mean, I thought I had literally, you know, hit the jackpot, which I think I did. But in any mm-hmm. case, the next day I was ready. Black limousine comes up, picks me up, takes me to the airport, and I'm on a flight to London for the weekend. I get to the Jim Henson Creature Shop. They make a mold of my face, and they take these measurements of my body and so forth. It just so happens. Now, here's the thing, Bob, too, is I did the second movie, which is called Secret of the Ooze, which you guys saw. But the first one was done by Hong Kong stuntmen, which did a fabulous job. I mean, those guys are great. I did the second one. In other words, it went SAG, and I had gotten my SAG card about, you know, two months before. Anyway, it just so happened I fit the other guy's body. You know, in other words, the hand, the torso and all that all fit me perfectly. They just had to make a bust of my head to fit the helmet or Michelangelo Fugly on my face, because in the movie we're required to do flips and stuff like that, so it has to be almost like a football helmet where it fits snug.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so they did that. Yeah, so I was basically there for the weekend. Didn't see anything of London, only from what I saw from the plane, but that's about it. So as we were leaving, and then I went back home. They gave me a couple of hands of practice and nunchucks, because as you know, there's only three fingers on of the hand of the turtle.
Yeah,
so they gave me a couple of hands to work the nunchucks. Basically, I had to have two of my hands, almost like the Spock, you know, the Spock thing.
Oh, yeah.
So basically, that's how I worked them, and I worked it pretty hard. Plus, I had to learn how to do the yo-yo, which I wasn't really familiar with as much, but I did what I could. And so that, another month or two passed. They sent me back to London because it's finished. They wanted to get a final fitting. Everything fit perfectly. Again, it was just a weekend. I go back to L.A., and then another month, we are flown to North Carolina for 3 months. The first month, we get with Pat. We get the costumes on. We get our choreography together. We see what we can do, what we can't do in the suit. And basically, first, Pat asks us, well, what are your specialties? What can you do? And so forth. So we kind of took our strong points, and then he built off that, which I think is the sign of a, you know, obviously a veteran, a stunt coordinator and so forth. And so it was really a pleasure to work with Pat and the whole crew. Again, we're seeing what we can and cannot do. And here's a lot of responsibility on the foot soldiers, is what they were called, the henchmen. They had to be, you know, in the right place at the right time, because our vision was very limited. We really couldn't see peripheral. We can only see kind of slightly in front of us underneath the bands and so forth. But we put it together. What we couldn't do, we changed until we got what we could do. So,
very cool.
That's the movie part of that. And that was pretty exciting, extremely exciting. Met some fascinating, you know, veteran stuntmen. Terry Leonard, I don't know if you're familiar with Terry Leonard, but Terry Leonard was our second unit director, and he, his claim to fame, if you will, was the Raiders of the Lost Ark. When you see the Harrison Ford is underneath the truck as it's going, and he has his whip. Remember, he has his whip, and he has to drag, and he kind of lets go, and he's kind of dragging underneath the truck to the other side. Anyway, Terry Leonard did that. So,
oh, wow.
Very cool. Yeah. And then plus you have Stephen Ho, who is the Donatello stunt action turtle. But, by the way, we like to be called at the time, you know, action turtles. We kind of wanted to get away from, you know, stuntmen.
action turtles.
Yes. So Stephen Ho was Donatello. Larry Lamb was Leonardo. And Hosan Park was Raphael. Yeah. These guys were straight off. Yeah, they were coming straight off the circuit. These guys were, you know, I mean, they can kick and hold their legs up there. Again, I was a fighter, so I mean, to be quite honest, I was a little, you know, I mean, I was a little intimidated by this because, you know, these guys were sharp.
Yeah, Larry Lamb and, those guys were sharp back then.
Yeah, and Stephen Ho and Hosan Park. So, but they took me in and they showed me stuff and, you know, they accepted me and they made me feel, you know, quite welcome, probably better than what I really am. So then I really had a great time.
That's so cool. Now, I have a quick question, yeah. Speaking of Action Turtles. Because it's funny that you mentioned that, because it's like I remember being at a seminar with Sifu Aldakaskas, and it was around the time before they started filming, right? Okay. And he said, oh, I heard from Ernie Reyes that they're looking for some turtles or whatever. So they need someone short. Someone that can kick, you know, that kind
of
thing.
For lack of a better word, right?
Yeah, they need someone short to fit the costumes and stuff like that, right? So, you know, if you're interested in, you know, applying for it, get a headshot and go do it, right? And we were like, oh, okay, whatever. And then, like, after Turtles 2 came out, Sifuel, you know, called me one day and he's like, why didn't you get the hint? I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, the turtle thing. And I'm like, I didn't think you were talking to me. I mean, I'm not a stunt person, that kind of thing. He's like, look around. A whole bunch of, like, tall white people. Who's short? And I was like, okay, whatever. But I would have been completely, you know, intimidated by Larry Lamb and, you know, all those, you know, competition circuit guys. I would have. And I don't, you know, at the time, I don't think they would have chosen a woman either. So, but my question actually is, speaking of which, you know, the costume, how much does that weigh, and how much did that actually affect your guys' full range of movement?
Okay, well, you know, how much did it weigh? That's been a good question. I think the answer was, if I remember, 20 to 30 pounds about, you know, on your
man.
Back. 25 pounds, something like that. And think about wearing, you know, now it's all connected and it's all latex and rubber, but it's kind of like having a wetsuit on, but you have like three layers of a wetsuit on. So the range of motion, you know, was pretty difficult because of the resistance to stretch it. You know what I mean?
Wow.
So, yeah, I know. But the Jim Henson people, they had foam latex. So in other words, it was like 3 inches of foam all around your body. So you're kind of insulated in a little cocoon type of thing. And as far as, so the range of motion was extremely difficult. But, again, those guys made it look easy. They had to pick me up, and that's when I kicked. No, I'm just joking. But, you know, I mean, I could kick, but I could not hold it there. So, in other words, you know, and I could kick, but, again, like I said, I didn't have the control and the flexibility to really hold the kicks. I would kick and then kind of release and, you know, kick back. So in other words, I would, I guess it goes to what you know, Bruce Lee says, you know, in other words, I want to show actual fighting. So in a real fight, you're not going to hold it. But, you know, I mean, as you do film, you're going to want to be more versatile than that. Even Bruce Lee eventually, you know, needed kicks here and there that were different from when he actually fought outside. Because he visually, a lot of those kicks outside will not work on screen. So there's a difference there. But it's up to you, the person, to train them to be effective outside or inside, whatever you want to do with them. So. And then as far as the vision, as I mentioned, when you put on the helmet itself, you know, when you have the bands on, right underneath the eye piece and then the band, right underneath by the nose, we had little, you know, basically slits. And that was our vision. That and the mouth sometimes, if we didn't have a black mesh in there, but they would put a black mesh there, you could still kind of see. So it was basically you were there and just, thank God you were padded, because sometimes you might hit something that you weren't supposed to, or walking. Well, sometimes it's just, you know, in all the action that's happening, you know what I mean? You get lost sometimes. But that's why we worked as a team, and the other side, which were the stunt guys, had to be in the right places as well.
You guys, though, didn't do the actual acting and voices, did you? That was all done by Foley and those guys.
Now, wait a minute, Bob. Are you trying to give away our secrets?
This is the only show we've ever had where I'm actually taller than the host and our guest.
Bob, I did everything. I'm Michelangelo. What are you talking about? No. Yeah. Here's the
well, now back then you may have.
But that, well, no, I didn't, though. Here's the thing. Actually, each turtle was made up of four people and one guy who did the real heavy-duty stunts for all the turtles. So let me explain it.
Wow.
In other words, I was considered the action turtle, did the martial arts, gymnastics, small pratfalls for the actor. The actor,
mm-hmm.
whose name was Michelin Sisti, who did one and two, and I think three as well, but I'm not sure. Maybe I think he did one and two for sure. In any case, he was fabulous. So I learned everything that I know from that character, from him and his puppeteer, which is Mac Wilson, who, of the Creature Shop. So in other words, mm-hmm. Mish, we called him Mish, he had the same suit as I did, but on his back was about an 80-pound battery.
Mm-hmm.
So think about, yeah, so 80 pounds. So basically,
dang.
You're not going to be able to do, you know what I mean, not going to be able to do much. I'm sorry, I have some dogs here. My dog. But anyway, you're not going to be able to do all your tricks and stuff on flips with an 80-pound battery on your back. So,
mm-hmm.
and basically that battery had cables running out of his body to the side where Mac Wilson, the puppeteer, was viewing the monitor, had his keypad, and he was doing all the gestures of the face, which was all animatronic.
Mm-hmm.
The actor's face was all done by animatronic of the actor, of Michelangelo. So in other words,
mm-hmm.
these guys, during the month that we were choreographing the fight sequences, they were kind of working as a team, getting their lines down, their movements down, so it would look like one character. So they had to do their own thing for that month while we did the fight
wow.
sequences, and then we filmed the movie. So that's three people right there. Okay, now who's the fourth? Okay, then you had the voice, which was Robbie Reese, was the voice of Michelangelo in the first and second movie. And then you had, as I mentioned, the heavy-duty stunt guy who did high falls for Shredder, for all the turtles, and air rams. So you step on, like,
mm-hmm.
a little – you guys are familiar with air rams? Like where you step on
– I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
I almost broke my ankle.
Yeah, and it launches you, and it gives an effect like in the movie where you have the giant turtle and the Wolverine. I think it was a turtle. Anyway, one of those guys picked Michelangelo, and he threw him into the wall. That was an
mm-hmm.
air ram that the guy stepped on, and it just kind of throws you. It's got a hydraulic on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you got and what the interesting thing about that, because I eventually did one. I'll tell you that in a second, but once you step on it, it kind of releases the hydraulic, and it, again, like I said, it throws you. So you have to really get your body weight, and you got to really pin it down and dial it in to how far you're going to be thrown, because you got to get the mat out there and so forth, because it can be quite dangerous if you do it wrong. And plus, you got to lock out your leg as you step
mm-hmm.
on it, because it's got to give something. You know, you can't
yeah.
really have a soft leg, is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
so
or you break something, yeah.
Or you'll break something, right, if there's too much
yeah.
force on it, exactly. So anyway, that was all done, all those stunting, and he did a ratchet as well when they threw somebody into.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Tom DeWeer. He still does a stunt. He's, you know, what I call a heavy-duty stunt guy. He's a fabulous guy, and it was a great to know him as well. Let's see. So, and then again, as I mentioned, you had the voice. So, you know, a lot of people went into making each character, and then the final result was what you see up on the screen. So,
that's amazing.
Wow, that is very cool. Now, Nick, I was reading yesterday. Now, I want you to consider. I posted the picture of you and I up on my Facebook page. I start getting bitched at by my niece. And my niece
Why?
Is like 27 because
Why?
I didn't tell her I was going to go see a Ninja Turtle.
Well, did you tell her it wasn't your fault because you didn't know I was going to be there, right?
That's right. I had no clue. I had no clue you were going to be there. Now, you do a lot of special appearances for birthday parties and that sort of thing. Yesterday, I was reading what you sent me, and you were playing a different turtle. You weren't playing Michelangelo. So do you have, like, all of the Ninja Turtle costumes?
Boy, I wish I did, but no, I don't. Here's what happened yesterday. Okay, So basically, when I Rastita, let me bring you up to and you too, Bob. About a month ago, you know, I've been thinking about this for the last several years of getting, you know, a mask of Michelangelo. So I ended up finding one, and then I asked if the guy made the suit, and he did, but he wanted an enormous amount of money for it, much more than I could afford at the time. So I said, well, I could do this much, and then I can help you, you know, get it out there. I haven't heard from him. I still haven't heard from him. So I asked on Facebook. I have some friends. You know, the whole culture of the turtles kind of evolved away from me, which I didn't know of. So I found some people that introduced me to this guy. His name is Daniel Bravo. I took a look at what he had from a friend, and then I contacted him on Facebook, and I asked if I can go down and see his product. So I ended up going down. It's 2 hours out of L.A. I'm down there, and I believe me, I thought I was having flashbacks. I mean, the moment I put that head on, I just, man, it looked as if Jim Henson had done these costumes. So I said, cool. You know what, I want one. Yeah, and he was, you know, he said, sure. I mean, you're the original guy. You got it. But I mean, I did pay him, of course, but it was also a fraction of the cost, which this other guy who I wanted to get it from, which is a smaller head and didn't really look the same. But it looked good, but it wasn't exactly like this one. This one reminds me so much of the movie that I think I'm going to be shooting in just a second, the actual scenes from another Turtle movie. That's how real it is. So anyway, this guy, Daniel Bravo, has a friend, and they go to different Comic-Cons and different places and events with the four turtles, because he makes the suits. He has four people and friends that do it. Well, he introduced me to another friend of theirs called Jason Ibarra, who happened to be the Red Ranger of the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers for 10 years or something like that. So, you know, I never met this guy. Don't ask me. I'm going to ask him eventually, actually, how did you get involved with the turtles? No, but anyway, he has the turtle suit. This is how he loves the turtles, he said, and he has the turtle suit, and he has made a custom turtle van. So if you go to you should go TMNT van, which, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle van, you'll see everything about Jason Ibarra. And he has a van there. And so they actually at Comic-Cons and different events, they want the van there as well. So they, you know, they'll actually trailer it there wherever they need it. It's a big industry, right? And there's a big money in this, which is interesting because who would have thought, right?
Right.
So anyway, this guy, he does parties, and I wanted to get, because, I mean, I had been getting people requests to go to different events and to do different demonstrations, and, you know, and as my, you know, but I didn't have the costume. So basically now that I have, so, I mean, I was asked still to do that stuff, but now that I have the costume, it's kind of up my ante, you know what I mean? And so, you know, so, I mean, it's really gave me more clout, so to speak. So anyway, so Jason has been doing that, and so he has an overflow of events that he has on his plate. So basically, I just said, "Well, I'll help you out," and so I helped him out. About a week and a half ago, I did my first birthday party at an elementary school for an hour over here by the airport, Los Angeles, LAX. And it was called Beethoven Elementary School. So I went there as Mikey, and boy, and this was kindergartners. Man, I got away with it. I was doing great. I was doing Mikey, and because I am Mikey, right? I played I was him. And I was there, and I had my sausage nunchucks from the movie. Wow, it was great. But I'm thinking an hour is too long, because eventually these kids, you know, they're starting to figure out, hey, you know what? There's somebody in that costume. And so then I'm feeling them grabbing me here, grabbing me there. My shell's coming off. You know what I mean? I'm trying to get out of there, and I got out of there intact. But boy, that was maybe an hour is a little too long for kindergartens. I don't know, but but I had a great time. It was my first one back, and I think I had, you know, I had more of a blast than the kids did. We really had a good time there. And then he had another one that I did last week. Well, this weekend, he had one in Fillmore, and you know where Fillmore is, right, Bob?
Which
is
by Moore Park.
Yes. Oh, yeah, just on the other side of Moore Park. Rastita, I'm driving out there, And wow, actually, it's a beautiful drive. But I'm going up to 101, then going north on the 23, which is kind of going to wrap around to where Simi Valley is, which is behind this huge mountain chain. And then I take north 23 through this whole range of mountains that I swear it looked like China. I mean places that look so fascinating. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, this is going to be great, you know, one day to film movies out here. So I'm going to keep that tucked in my mind. But anyway, eventually get out to Fillmore, get there a little early because I have to do a birthday party for a young kid that's 3 years old. And the day before, I'm talking to his parents to get the directions and so forth. And I say, all right, I'll be there. Mikey will be there. I'll be there with my mask and everything. And the father goes, what? Mikey, we want Leo.
Oh.
I go, what did you mean, Leo? I'm Mikey, Michelangelo. And then he goes, no, well, we had asked, you know, Jason, because Jason's doing his overflow of business. And so I say, okay, well, I'm going to call Jason. We'll try to straighten it out. So I call him up, let him know what happens. He calls the father up. He ends up having a mask of Leo, brings it to me. You're Leo. And I said, okay. I ended up taking the Leo mask. I was Leo. But I told the father this, because I told the father, okay, Bob, how old is your niece?
She's 28.
Okay. Well, no, though, because here's the thing. All right, because those people that are 28 and 30 and 31 and 32, they're all having the kids that are having these parties, to be quite honest. So it's kind of like, you know what I mean? It's kind of like there's an emotional tie there. So anyway, I go and I meet the father, Joseph, and I'm telling him, you know, yeah, I'm going to be Leo. Here's the Leo. I got there. It's open. But I originally was Michelangelo in the second movie. And he goes, what? That was my favorite, you know, when I was a kid. I go, yeah, I know. And I want to be Michelangelo here. And so we put our heads together and we go like this. Well, okay, 3/4 of the party, I'm going to be Leo. And then I had to, then while they're doing something, I'm going to say goodbye, I'm leaving now, and then I left. So I was Leo about 3/4 of the party, had a good time with Leo, because I never really played him, but I did watch the movie beforehand just to kind of get his character down. And to be quite honest, I think it was a little shorter Leo than most. But don't tell anybody that either. So
okay.
I come back, I run into the party, and I'm Michelangelo. I'm saying, I'm late. And I'm sorry I'm late. And the little boy's name was Joseph Oprah. Also, he was 3 years old. I run up to him. I do some flips and things like that. I roll and I get into the kids. And the kids are chasing me around the room. And they're all, we're out. I mean, I'm Michelangelo. I have to be me. I had a great time. But I have to be Michelangelo. But I was Leo for a little while. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
But Nick, isn't there more to it than just the mask? Because you have the M on the belt buckle, that sort of thing. But you only change the mask for Leo?
Yeah. Well, actually, there is the weapons. You're right. Well, at the school, when I went to do the school party, of course, no weapons were allowed, which is right, and so you have to respect that. But yeah, this party he had. Leonardo swords, which I was able to get from his father, and I put him, in there. Because, yeah, right, I didn't have anything. What I actually had in mind going there, which I probably should have done beforehand, but when I got there, I was looking for a party store. I was going to get those long balloons that you can kind of form into a sword or something.
Oh,
I thought
it
would have been a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, ended up not being able to do that, so I had to go to, plan B, and thank God I did plan B, and I basically had a staff, a plastic tube that I cut in half that would, kind of represent two type of swords, almost like the Kali, right? Kali thing.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, what happened that he had the swords there, so I ended up using his son's swords, and his son actually took him away from Leonardo, and he did his own little routine of swords, so he has been practicing. So he's an up-and-coming turtle, this little kid. And you're right. And so you're right. So Leonardo has swords, two swords. Michelangelo has the nunchucks. The size, Raphael has the size. And the staff is Donatello's.
Mm-hmm.
And let me let you in on a little secret here, too. The third movie, which they go back in time to Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, that movie was, on the second movie, and I hate to say this, but we actually got, I got injured on that shoot. Do you guys remember the movie at all?
The second one or the third one?
The second one, actually? When they're at one point they were kind of sneaking around in this junkyard, the three turtles, which is Michelangelo, Leonardo, and Donatello. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They're sneaking around because the foot had captured Raphael, and they have him taped up and on his post. So we're sneaking in around in the junkyard, looking around, and there's a trap set for us. And there's a huge cargo net with a steel frame on the outside of that cargo net. Well, this is how the actual scene was supposed to go. We step on that cargo net. That cargo net, you know, all of a sudden comes up because it's attached to a hydraulic cable and a hydraulic lift off, you know, in the rafters of the sound stage. So it's supposed to take us 20 feet off the ground like that, you know, just like that. Well, it does that. We're going up about 8 feet off the floor. The cable actually snapped, and we're right on that. I know. It just was an incredible, awful experience. We're back on the ground so fast, we don't even know what happened. You know what I mean? Because, you know, like I said, that force of that thing going up so fast and all of a sudden it snapped and we're down that fast was, it was very weird, to say the least. Anyway, so we're actually hurt. Okay, we're actually hurt because what happened was that steel frame landed on Stephen Ho's ankle.
Oh,
and if they did not evacuate him pronto, that ankle was swelling so big that he may have lost his whole foot. It was surreal in a sense. He was out of the chute from that point on, and we just had about maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks left. So we had done pretty much everything. This was kind of like towards the tail end, just a kind of background, maybe fight sequences, and that was it. But he was out of the chute, and we had to get a replacement for him, which was his friend David Wald at the time. And then Larry Lamb compressed his back to the point where it just, you know, ruined his lower back and stuff. So he was pretty much out of the chute. What happened to me is a week before this incident happened, I had slammed in a fight sequence in the disco scene my inner knee actually against the floor of this disco. And the way we have the turtle suits is that you put it on piece by piece, and in between the joints you kind of have the little covering of the pads, right? But it still exposes your bone and so forth.
Oh,
anyway, it slammed and bruised my inner knee. Yeah, it was bruised, and I could still run, and I could still, you know, move and stuff like that. But once that ended, I finished the shoot. But to be quite honest, every time in the scene we had to move laterally, like sides and stop, my knee would buckle. So it kept on happening, and so eventually they got another guy kind of to do things that I couldn't do, but I still pretty much finished the movie, but barely. And his name was Buzzsaw. He was I forgot his actually Chris something. I'm sorry, but his name is Buzzsaw. Sorry, Buzz. great guy, great martial artist as well. I don't want him coming after me.
Right.
But anyway, he kind of helped me in certain scenes, which is great. But anyway, so after we finished the shoot, we had the big party at the end. It still bothered me. So later on, I went to see what the problem was. I went to get an MRI, and I had severed my MCL, which is medial collateral ligament, on that side. Yeah, it hurts, and even to this day, just saying that chills me. Yeah, so that's why.
And you finished the shoot. Wow.
Well, I finished the shoot, but I did have to really tighten it up, like really secure it. In fact, I had a steel, one of those braces that had the steel joints on the end, like on the side. Because I knew that they kept on, you know, but I didn't know what, you know, that I had actually severed it. If I would have known probably on the shoot, I probably would have stopped at that point because, you know, I definitely needed an operation because at that, it was completely severed. So that was why I could not have the stability to stop because that, that stabilizes your knee, obviously, keeps it in place. And without that, it kept on just, it was like Gumby, you know what I mean?
Silent. Oh, man.
It was It was weird. Even talking about it's weird. But anyway, so I got that fixed. We went through a workers' comp, all of us, and we were able to, you know, our injuries were all, you know, bettered after, for me, years, because I didn't think I would walk again. But, yeah, I had to get that in. They cut me open, and they basically stapled that immediate MCL together. And, you know, 25 years later, it's probably, it's good. It's still holding up. And, I mean, it's great, actually, because I don't have any problems with it. So, but anyway, so they ended up doing the third movie, and because I was injured, and plus they were going to do it up in Canada, they had to cast 70% Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Basically, I didn't basically make, at this time, this is 93, I believe, 92, 93, and that's it, at that time, I didn't make the cut, basically, to say the least. Yeah, so they hired another actor for Michelangelo contracted, which is, his name is Shashir Inakola, which he did a fabulous job. But then Pat Johnson called me up one day and said, well, you know what, we still would like you to be in it as one of the bad guys. So I said, sure, you know, I still wanted to work on it. And so I ended up going up there as, because, you know, it takes place in ancient Japan. And because it takes place in ancient Japan, you know, I mean, if you see me, I probably couldn't pass as a Japanese, you know what I mean, person,
yeah.
Or an Asian person. So they had me, my back always to the camera. But I did work with Al DeCosco Sr. on that. In fact, you know, and I'm sorry that this happened to him, but one of the horses on the battlefield, maybe you remember, Rustita, when he may have been injured at one point, a horse stepped on his foot. And,
Yeah,
so they had to get him evacuated, and that was an awful time for him and for the shoot, but I'm glad he's better and back and so forth. But that was fun to be on that side. And then at one point I did end up getting to be Donatello in one scene where they slide down this tube for that movie, because during the course of filming the movie, sometimes you need the turtles to be in different scenes at one time, you know what I mean? So we had, you know, so they needed Donatello in another scene, but Stephen Ho was doing something else, so they asked me to get in the suit, and I said, you know, sure. But I'm Michelangelo, I said. No, I'm just joking. But,
I gotta be me!
Yeah, I gotta be me! You can't do that to me! That's not contract!
That's really good. I mean, dang, you sound just like Mikey. Oh, my God.
No,
that's awesome.
No, but you know, that's only because I've been watching the movie over and over. No, I'm just playing. But I haven't seen it in a long time. I did replay it, though, the other day. And, well, I thought for you know, for what it is, they did a fabulous job. You know, all around, it was just fabulous. So,
see, I'm
going
to have
making...
to watch it now. I'm going to have to watch it again now.
And you're talking to me? Come on.
Yeah, and I'm talking to Mikey. I got to, you know, now I got to watch it.
I know. Sure. Well,
but,
I hope you're doing it.
I think I'm going to go look it up on Netflix or something. But you know what, Nick? The time has just flew by. Our live feed is going to go off here in about, like, 3 minutes. Last but not least, for any of our listeners out there that might want to get a hold of you and maybe ask you some questions about how to get into the stunt industry, especially for martial arts for film, how can they contact you? Can they contact you through Facebook? Do you have your own website?
Yeah.
How can they contact you?
Yeah, I do have my website. If they go to, again, www.nickpalma, and I'll spell that because it's going to be PALMA.com and you know, there's a, you can message me through there, and that would be a good start. But I guess what I suggest is just start building those skills as far as athletically, and also with drama. I took a lot of acting as well, and I'm still taking it. You know, just build whatever skills you can, and just be prepared and have something ready, because you never know when opportunity knocks. You want to be ready.
Very
exactly.
Cool. Nick, are you going to be Michelangelo at Dragon Fest this year?
You bet I am. I mean, I'm going to have turtles as well, so we're all going to be there. The van will not be there, but we love to see the fans. We'd love to see you guys.
Yeah, you bet.
We've got a booth there.
We have to.
All
yeah,
right.
We have a booth there.
And you know
what?
We're going to take. Oh, we're going to take you down to our Subway Turtle Hangout for some pizza. All right?
That's so cool. Oh, my gosh. And, Bob, we have to get a picture with these guys. Definitely we have to get a picture with Nick.
Oh, absolutely. I can't wait to see you. Both of you.
Yeah, okay. And we'd love to interview a little bit more, hopefully at Dragon Fest, because we're going to be doing some interviews there. So awesome!
Okay, well,
thank
forward.
You so much. Yeah,
well, this is
thank
great.
You.
I loved it. You know, I didn't know what to talk about, but once I started talking, now you can't shut me up. No, I'm sorry.
Oh man, you know, we need to, you know, maybe after Dragon Fest if you're not doing anything. Yeah, let's go have a beer. Awesome.
Okay.
Awesome. So thank you so much for joining us, Nick, and we'll see you at Dragon Fest.
You bet. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys, and thank you, audience. I look forward to seeing you all at Dragon Fest, May 18th, 1 through
May
7 p.m.
18th. Yes.
Bye.
And
that's right.
That's
Bob, Robert, great to know you both. Respita.
Yes,
you
thank
too,
you.
Nick.
You
thank
too.
You, sir.
You bet.
And before bye-bye. We sign off, bye-bye now.
Good. Okay.
And before we sign off, I want to remind our listeners that next week is Easter, so we're not going to be doing a live show. We're going to throw up a retro show, and it's going to be a surprise because even I don't know what show I'm going to throw up there. But we'll be back in 2 weeks, and real quick, Bob, if you can tell our listeners who we'll be having in about 2 weeks.
Well, we're going to be having writer, producer, director, Matthew Ziff. He's working on a project with the Wilson brothers, and TJ Storm. We're going to have him on in 2 weeks.
Right on. So stay tuned in 2 weeks. Stay tuned to next week too. I don't know. It's going to be a surprise. I don't know what retro episode I'm going to throw up there. So just tune in, and we'll see everyone in 2 weeks. Bye-bye, everybody. Good night, Nick.
Bye. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.